And welcome back to Coast to Coast as we talk about dreams of other worlds, the amazing story of unmanned space exploration. Stand by for a couple exciting hours in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's great to have Chris Impey back with us on Coast to Coast University, distinguished professor in the astronomy department at the University of Arizona out there in Tucson. His research interests are in observational cosmology, gravitational lensing, evolution, structure of galaxies as well. Number of books he's written, you can find them on his website, chrisimpey.com. Dreams of Other Worlds. Chris, always fun talking space with you. How are you?
I'm great, George, and good to be back on your show.
Me too. You know, since we were last on, and you were on with me about 2 years ago, so many things keep happening in space. Technology just keeps getting better and better, and, you know, the Chinese are up there now. Everybody's up there. Where do you see it headed in the next 15 years?
Well, I think it's going to, you know, explode in a good way. And it's interesting because, you know, people sort of feel like NASA's in the doldrums and Americans can't put someone into orbit. So if you just look at the small picture, it kind of looks a bit depressing. I mean, the people who are space advocates could think, you know, we're going nowhere. We haven't been back to the moon for 40 years. You can make a list. But if you, the bigger picture is really interesting because, of course, we're seeing the beginnings of this private space industry. People like Elon Musk with SpaceX have now serviced the space station 3 times. I mean, it's really happening. Richard Branson, who's a little bit full of bluster maybe, is actually he's probably going to have his first real flight late this year or early next. And so that is going to happen, and it's going to keep the government agencies like NASA on their toes, and they're, you know, they're not direct competitors, but the game is just opening up, basically. So I think it's going to be very exciting.
In terms of privatization, I think Musk's company is way ahead of the curve, don't you think?
Yeah, and he's, you know, there are some number of space entrepreneurs, and they're some really smart people. And, you know, he's the sort of triple threat because he has extremely deep pockets. He's a very talented technical person, and he's a relentless businessman. I mean, he's sort of working on all cylinders. I hope he doesn't burn out, but he's doing some really interesting things.
Is he making any money with his space company yet?
No, but he actually got some pretty sweet deals through NASA. So his supply missions for the space station are worth in aggregate hundreds of millions of dollars, which is still saving NASA money because the shuttle was so expensive. So, you know, in a sense, you could say he's being sort of subsidized a bit with his government contracts. So just helping him out as he gets launched. But he's going to bring the price, you know, the key is just this one number, this price per pound, price per kilo to get into low Earth orbit. And that number with the best, you know, massive Russian rockets, which are 40 years old now and haven't really been updated, is $2,000 or $3,000 for a kilo. And he's going to bring that down potentially to $200, but down by a factor of 10. That's going to change everything.
Yeah, it sure is. Now, you know, Project Paperclip, when we brought the Germans, the scientists here after the war, you know, was really the impetus for our space program. And then, you know, I watched the competition with the Soviet Union at the time. We beat them to the moon, and things then kind of slowed down a little bit. I'm amazed at how companies like Musk's company can be so fast technologically. Is it because he hired former NASA employees, people who knew how to design rockets and things like that? Because there's no way he could have just gone to the college campuses and hired people. So where do you get the experienced workers, Chris?
Yeah, you're right. He did plunder NASA, sort of some mid-level and not ready to retire people who are a little frustrated at the pace of NASA projects and the government funding. So he did that, and then he grew his own. And I think what he did was he just set up a culture in his young company of, you know, questioning the conventional wisdom. You know, don't just do it this way because we've done it this way before. You know, another sort of slightly dysfunctional part of the traditional way of doing space is that it's a sort of, there's a military-industrial complex, if you like. The sort of standard big vendors, the Boeings and the companies of the world that do their work for NASA, they get a little comfortable and they're not really willing to try new things. And so you have these situations where all the major countries are using technology that's 30, 40, 50 years old. And so in a sense, is just ripe for a revolution, ripe for someone who said, no, we're going to start from scratch. We're going to design something that's truly reusable as opposed to the sort of fake reusable concept of the space shuttle. We're going to, you know, we're going to break the old model. And he's not the only one doing it, of course. He gets maybe the most publicity, but there's, you know, a set of four or five entrepreneurs with their young companies. And there's going to be a shakedown. We don't know who the big players 10 or 20 years from now are going to be, but it's very interesting competition amongst these new players.
Well, when you think of the technology that we use to get on the moon, 45-year-old technology as of today. Now, when we landed on the moon in 1969, if you subtract the 45 years from that period, then you're dealing with them saying, look, we used to have 1925 technology. I mean, look at the amazing difference between 1925 and 1969, and then from 69 to where we are today, Chris, there hasn't been that much of an explosion in technology, or has there been?
Well, there have been things sort of happening that are not quite as prominent. The hard game, of course, is lifting these heavy payloads, and people are heavy. So the manned space program has always been a challenge because it just costs a lot of money in terms of energy and then in terms of real money to lift these heavy payloads. Meanwhile, there's been this sort of miniaturization revolution. So we now have nanosatellites, and we're sort of leveraging the best of the information technology revolution. So if you just get away from the fact of sending people up there with all the expensive and heavy equipment needed to keep them comfortable and alive, then there has actually been a revolution. So the satellite business has been revolutionized by miniaturization. So some sectors of the space industry have actually really been growing in very exciting ways while we look like we've been treading water on the manned space program.
In theory, if we wanted to send a man back to the moon or even get to Mars, how quickly do you think we could do it with the advanced technology we have today?
Well, we've got the SLS, the Space Launch System, which is a sort of Constellation revamped American, you know, that's the NASA heavy lift capability, which is under development and would be ready to go in a couple of years. So, you know, we're a couple of years, 3 to 4 years away from being able to send astronauts back to the moon or perhaps onto Mars. And you know, the capability is also there in several countries. The Chinese have come on incredibly strongly. They spend a lot smaller fraction of their GDP than America does on space program. But, of course, they've been growing their space program at the rate their economy is growing, which is 10% a year. You take a decade of 10% a year growth compared to flatline budgets in the U.S., and that's going to buy you some pretty impressive progress.
Well, there's no doubt about that. What about other countries like North Korea? They do have a space program in that they can launch rockets, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, and they, you know, their technology is really very primitive. So if you're a country that just wants to do copycat on these 40 or 30 or 40 or 50-year-old technologies, the kerosene rocket, basically, kerosene and liquid oxygen, that's been around, you know, since Goddard, essentially, you can get into the game, and that's the easy way in for some countries. But, for example, the Chinese, they, of course, started by licensing, they licensed a huge amount of Russian technology when the Russians were strapped for cash in the mid-1990s. And in the way they often do, they sort of reverse engineered and copied Russian technology and some of ours. But they also innovated, and their best, the Long March rocket, which is their heavy lift rocket, is actually very innovative, uses different fuels, is very well designed. So there's some small players who are, you know, getting into the game by copying old technology, and then the big players are innovating. And so it's a new space race, essentially.
Okay, so let's talk about your new work, Dreams of Other Worlds. Tell me about the title, first of all.
Well, the title was designed to be evocative because, we know, the big thing that's happened in the last 20 years in my subject in astronomy really is exoplanets. It's the discovery of solar systems elsewhere and now Earth-like worlds. And that, the book is not entirely about that, but it was designed to sort of bring together as a common thread the idea of other worlds, whether they're fascinating worlds within our solar system, like Titan or Enceladus or Europa or Mars itself, or these new worlds that are being found in distant solar systems, or, you know, the big enchilada, the sort of the universe itself. You know, how many worlds are there in the universe now that we've counted all the galaxies? So that was just the common thread that I wanted to use to tie together these different missions.
You looked at some of these missions and then picking up the different ones that you had. I mean, you could have picked others too. How'd you key in on what you had?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a little arbitrary, and some people have written me and said, "Why'd you leave out my favorite mission?"
What about this one?
It is hard. They're all children, and everyone loves.
Book would be 9 feet tall if you put them all in there.
So they were, you know, most of them are NASA missions. And a number of them have European Space Agency cooperation. So they're almost all international missions in terms of the scientists involved. And they span the full 40 years of the core of our, unmanned space program. So we start with Viking, which is people forget about Viking. That's almost 40 years since Viking launched. It was an extraordinary mission for the time, the twin orbiters and landers testing for life on Mars, really in a way that we haven't since. So some of them just picked themselves. So for an old mission, that was an easy one. And then some of the NASA great observatories are in there working, the Hubble, of course, and Chandra working at X-ray wavelengths, Spitzer working at infrared wavelengths. And then some of them may be more obscure to some people, like Hipparchus is mostly a European mission designed just to map out the galaxy. It was just cartography of the stars in the nearest few hundred light years, just the sort of, classic type of astronomy where you map out our position in the Milky Way. And then I finished with a niche mission, which also maybe not as famous to everyone, WMAP, its acronym, which is a microwave background mapper, which has really told us about the very early universe and in the Big Bang in the first fractions of a second. So, spectacular science from just a very purpose-built mission just designed to do one thing, and it did it incredibly well.
Favorite mission of all time, what would it be?
Wow, that's really hard. I mean, it's a little personal just because I haven't used all these missions or got data from them, but I'm a Hubble user. I've had a number, maybe a dozen projects over the time span of Hubble. And, Hubble, wins my vote personally just because the pictures are spectacular, the data's spectacular. It's not a big telescope. People forget if you put the Hubble mirror in a list of the world's largest telescopes, it doesn't crack the top 100. It's not that big a telescope. It's the size of your dining room table. Now we make, at Arizona, we make telescope mirrors that are the size of a house. So it's done an incredible job. It's well into its third decade now, going strong with new instruments, refurbished every 4 or 5 years, but now no more because it's not going to be serviced again. So, and I've used it over almost its full span. I got data from the very first cycle of data, and then more recently, too. So I like Hubble, and I think the public loves Hubble, too.
Yeah, it's a great telescope. I'm amazed it's still clicking along, limping, I guess, at about this time, don't you think?
Well, it's limping in one way. It's limping because it's always had problems with gyros, which fail at a rate that's still not actually well understood, because they test these things on the ground and they never fail at the rate they fail in orbit. But its instruments have been, booted into the next generation every 4 or 5 years. So each servicing mission has left Hubble in a lot better condition than it was before, with newer capabilities. And so Hubble's sort of been rejuvenated by the servicing missions, which incidentally play into this other big argument about, should we have robotic or unmanned things like Space Telescope or Voyager, or should we be putting astronauts up there? And if you look at Hubble, your answer would be both, because Hubble, is an automated telescope in space that does incredible things. Nobody touches it. It's run by a computer. Its sequence of observations is programmed by a computer, etc. But astronauts have done the most amazing things in the servicing missions. If you get into the astronaut program, the astronauts would fight like stink to be on a Hubble servicing mission, because it's the ultimate test of what they do. Those EVAs lasting 4 or 5 hours, multiple EVAs, hugely, actually dangerous work for astronauts, but hugely challenging and rewarding. So, Hubble was the example of, we need people up there too, we can't just have these clever robots.
Chris, how would you rate our unmanned mission program?
I think it's exceptionally good because, you know, the agency, NASA, has its own technical expertise, but they've really worked, they've partnered with institutions and universities like my own. You know, we were lucky in Arizona, we were the first university where they let us, you know, pretty much run everything except the launch itself. And that's now a model that they use. So I think the unmanned probes, the planetary probes, things like Cassini, things like Voyager, things like Viking, that Viking wasn't fully devolved to a university, but these missions are really leveraging the best talent we have at universities and research institutes. And they get a really good, and they're very competitive. I mean, to get one of these missions approved now, you go through a selection that probably starts with 100 great ideas, and they knock it down to 24, then they knock it down to 4, then they knock it down to 1. And so, you know, in a Darwinian sense, only really extraordinary ideas ever get funded, and they're using the best talent out there. So these missions have been, you know, exceptional, I think. And the success rate has been exceptionally good, too.
Where would you rate us compared to other countries? Still way out on top?
Oh, yeah. In terms of these unmanned probes and these planetary probes, no question. We're totally on top. Now, we have a very good and tight and long-standing partnership with the European Space Agency, ESA. So a number of the missions, I think probably a third of the missions I write about in Dreams of Other Worlds, are joint with the Europeans. And it's a seamless thing. You know, when you're an astronomer or a space scientist or a planetary scientist, you don't really, you know, you go to international conferences, you barely even notice whether your colleagues are from America or from Germany or Japan or whatever. That's one of the nice things about this field. It's very open, very international, very collaborative. Mm-hmm. But the expertise right here, you know, in our universities and research institutes and NASA itself, you know, some of the best people at the top of their game are the people working on these missions within NASA.
What are we looking for by going to space, Chris? What do we really want?
I think that's the best question of all, of course. Why do it at all? Because, you know, as you know, not everyone is gung-ho about space. Some people think we should be spending our time solving the plenty of problems we have on the Earth, and we should. I mean, there are two answers, really. The first is the pure sort of science-motivated answer is out of our intellectual curiosity, because we're driven to explore, because we're curious, and that's how we're built. That's in our genes. And exploring space is just an expression of that. The same thing that led humans, when they left Africa, to sort of roam around the entire planet within a few tens of thousands of years, an extraordinary migration of hunter-gatherers. So it's like built into us. That's one answer. And then the second answer is because it really has leveraged technology. It has made us do some things better and let us do some things better. For instance, that push to miniaturization, which is an absolute requirement of space because it costs more. The heavier the thing is, the more it costs, and the less reliable it is, the more likely it is to fail and leave you with an expensive problem in space. So it's pushed electronics, it's pushed miniaturization, it's pushed sensors, remote sensing capability, and you know, even at the level of manned space program, life support for astronauts, various things, learning about medical situations we've learned from studying space. So I think it's the technology of space, forgetting just about rockets themselves. There's a whole set of technologies involved in space exploration, and we've improved our game, and it's affected other fields as well.
And you would say it was worth it. So far, to date, it was all worth it.
I think it's worth it, and, you know, that's a value judgment. You could say NASA, as our agency, has a budget of about $17.5 billion. That's obviously a lot of money, but it's 1% of the federal budget. And most people, when they're asked, would say, yeah, NASA's worth spending that kind of money on.
Chris, I want to get your take when we come back on going to Mars and going beyond, and what kind of information you think we're seeking. What are we after? We'll be back. Welcome back. Chris Impey with us. Of course, next hour we'll take your phone calls. We're talking about his work, Dreams of Other Worlds. When we dream about these other worlds, Chris, where are we dreaming? Mars? Beyond?
Where? Yeah, Mars is always going to be there in our dreams. I mean, because it goes back so far. You know, it starts with Percival Lowell over century ago up in northern Arizona, imagining there were canals there, and it really was his imagination, built by a dying race of Martians. And then we get in, you know, then it plays through the sort of lurid science fiction of the 1930s, Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, sort of amazing princes and princesses on Mars. And so the popular, and then there's Orson Welles and his radio show, of course, around the time of the Second World War, getting people so scared they left their homes and caused panic in New Jersey. So, you know, we've got a long time of thinking about Mars. It's sort of seeped into the popular consciousness. So we're always going to be dreaming of Mars. But there's, you know, there's some other cool places in the solar system, too. Most planetary scientists are really excited about Europa, of course, a water world that we now know has more water than the Earth, for instance. And if you think life depends on water, then that's a good place to look for life. And there's Titan, which is chemically weird with its ethane and methane, but has an atmosphere made of oxygen, made of mostly of nitrogen, like ours, actually thicker than our atmosphere. Could potentially have biology of a weird kind. So yeah, once you get into the outer solar system, there's some really exotic places that we'd love to take a closer look at.
Okay, you're an astronomer.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about the Big Bang. Chris, tell me your thoughts on just what it is. How did that start? Something from nothing. I can't get it.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, it's definitely the enigma of the concept, which is the something from nothing part. You know, we're in a big, old, empty, more or less empty and cold universe with 100 billion galaxies and all the stars they contain. So where did that come from? I mean, the Big Bang is a theory with a fair amount of data and evidence behind it now that just says that our universe 13.7 billion years ago was a vastly different place. It was in this incredibly compressed, hot, super dense state, and there was no structure. This is before any stars or galaxies had formed. So we've got all these pretty good pieces of evidence that say that long ago the universe was in an amazingly different state than it is now. So the Big Bang is the concept for the origination of the universe in a very hot, very dense state. The truth is the theory doesn't say why it happened or what came before and therefore what kicked it off. Some people have speculated about that, but even if they're being, you know, cautious as scientists, they always say, well, this is a little speculative. But the Big Bang as a description of our universe over 13.7 billion years from this incredible exotic early state to the state we find it now, that's a pretty robust and mature theory.
Okay, I just can't get it still. You know, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
I think the big one that's difficult for most people, and even scientists, of course, is you know, where was the Big Bang? Because the answer to that question in the science is everywhere. You know, that Big Bang is around us. There's no center of it. There's no edge of it. I mean, astronomers have found no edged space. When the Hubble looks out, or when we look out with the Hubble out to those very distant galaxies and those beautiful pictures, what you run out of is time. So when you look out in space, you look back in time because the light speed is finite and we're looking so far, we're looking back in time. So when Hubble runs out of galaxies, which pretty much does happen at the limits of its vision, you're just running out of time, not space. So there is no center and there's no edge. That's what the data says. So the only answer to the question where the Big Bang is it's everywhere.
What about the multiverses, the many universes?
That idea it's in the realm of speculation, but I would say it's sort of inching towards respectability and conventional science. And the reason is this, because if you do that backward extrapolation of our universe towards the Big Bang, you pretty much infer that the earliest phase of the universe was like a quantum state, because the universe itself was once smaller than an atom, if you follow the Big Bang all the way back to time zero. And so if the universe, you know, was once in a sort of quantum state, a very bizarre quantum state, then you have at least a conceptual basis for postulating that it wasn't the only quantum state. There were other quantum states of space-time out there, and maybe some of those, you know, didn't turn into a universe. Maybe some of them turned into other universes. Maybe some of them had different laws of physics. And the one that we inhabit, that iota of space-time, inflated to become the universe we live in. So that's sort of the gist of the multiverse idea. It's a very hard idea to test. I think cosmology at its cutting edge is really trying to test that idea. You know, how could we show that we live in a multiverse?
Where is it? Where are they? How come we can't see them?
Because they're beyond our space-time. They're beyond the edge of our vision or our horizon. So that might, and skeptics would say, well, then how do you know they're there? If they're
right.
beyond your space-time and you can't see them, well, the people making theories of the sort of precursor, the pre-Big Bang state, which is legitimate scientific speculation now, will say that there might be imprints into our universe, our space-time, from these other universes in the multiverse. And some of those imprints may come in the form of gravitational waves, for example, which is a signature that we're barely able to detect yet. We're just developing our first gravity wave detectors. So when we get that technology figured out, which is, you know, just the technology to be able to see with gravity eyes, if you like, we might actually have our first way of diagnosing whether the multiverse is a real idea.
Chris, do they connect to our universe, or is there a gap between them?
They could connect, or they could be completely distinct. Once you've got space-time in this sort of strange compactified state, then it's kind of warped. I mean, the universe is literally warped because you've got space-time that's highly curved. Space-time that we live in this old, flat, cold universe, is pretty much flat. The microwave satellites have actually measured the geometry of space, and it's flat. It's like Euclid would have said. But in the very early universe, this Big Bang state or this very early universe state, space-time was highly curved. You could think of it as knotted and convoluted. And in that situation, yes, you could have interpenetration of universes, or they could exist in different dimensions. That's another part of the mathematical concept of the multiverse. So the universes of a multiverse are probably independent of each other and never intersect or never talk to each other, but they might interpenetrate or they might have linkages that we, of course, want to try and figure out what they are so we can test for this idea.
It's fascinating and confusing at the same time, isn't it?
Well, I mean, and this is the math for this is beyond my pay grade, too. You know, I had to take a general relativity course as a grad student, and I probably forgot most of that. But the people who work on this theory, they live in that world. I mean, they've assimilated general relativity deep into their gut and at an intuitive level. And it is indeed fearsome and scary mathematics. And there's only probably a few hundred people in the world that can do this.
Life on Mars, was it there? Is it there?
I would think yes. I mean, it's a guess. We don't know. The surface of Mars, because Mars' atmosphere is so thin, Mars is an arid desert, a frozen arid desert as we look at it now. But the evidence that there's water under the surface right now as we speak is pretty strong, indirect but strong, and it's going to be kept liquid there by pressure from the top, by some mild heating, geological heating from the interior. And so this hypothesis that there are aquifers on Mars is a pretty good hypothesis. We'd love to test it. And if you've got water and you have carbon-rich material and you have energy, even if it's mild energy, you have all the conditions for life. And that's now. So I think there's a fair case to be made that Mars could have microbial life under the surface now. As for 3 billion years ago, then, you know, you'd almost be surprised if there weren't life on Mars, because 3 billion
right.
years ago, Mars was almost as habitable as the Earth was,
yeah,
as far as we
right.
can tell.
Something happened there.
Yeah, the atmosphere got away from it, basically. It's a little planet, you know, it's a quarter of the mass of the Earth. So it's on the edge of having plate tectonics and geological activity. It just could not retain that mostly carbon dioxide atmosphere. It just sort of leached off into space. So it's just dried out, and now it's this cold, arid desert.
Intelligent life out there on an Earth-like planet somewhere, yes or no?
Oh, yes. I mean, again, just speculation, but the numbers are almost getting compelling. You know, Kepler, which if I were, you know, the next edition of this book, that's the mission that would get its own chapter, of course.
Maybe its own book.
Oh, of course, its own book, and I think it's starting to get its own book. So Kepler is now, even though Kepler has reached the end of its prime time as a mission because it lost some of its capability last year, What it's, the data in the CAN has allowed us to estimate the number of Earth-like worlds in the Milky Way. So that's an extrapolation because most of the Kepler targets are hundreds of light years away and the Milky Way is huge. But it's a pretty good number. And if you just say what are the likely number of very Earth-like, so within 50% of Earth mass, habitable planets, so they're the right distance from their star for water to be liquid on the surface, you're looking at a number that's roughly 100 million, sorry, in the Milky Way. And that's the most conservative definition of habitable, because we know there are places in the outer solar system, far from our sun, which are basically cold worlds, where there could be habitability in certain places, especially under the surface. But if you just go for the Earth-like definition, that's 100 million worlds, and they've had a ton of time for something interesting to happen. Because remember, the universe is 13.7 billion years old, the Earth only 4.5 billion years old. So you could have had an Earth clone, a twin of our planet, that formed 7 or 8 billion years before the Earth
That's
did.
Right.
So you could have had all this incredible head start on, well, so whatever happened on the Earth, you could have that and then some on all these other Earths out there. So people sometimes forget the real estate is not just the real estate of space and world, but the real estate of time is important, too, in terms of what could or might happen.
With that thought, possible then that we have been visited by these extraterrestrials?
It's logically possible. I mean, I don't hold to that because I'm going to hold that idea, that hypothesis, if you like, to the standard bar of science, which will be, you know, verification, independent verification, evidence that scientists can inspect and scrutinize. And to my mind, that claim has not been substantiated at that level. But absolutely, it's logically possible. And you could even say, if there's 100 million habitable worlds in one galaxy, you'd be kind of surprised if in some of them intelligent life hadn't evolved.
Especially if they had that jump start in knowledge and in years.
That's right. I mean, there's a sort of something called the timing argument. And these arguments are not airtight, because as long as we only know of one planet with life, the Earth, and you're basing everything on a sample of one, which is not really strong science. But the timing argument would say that in a universe so capable of creating habitable worlds, and with so much time for that to have happened, we're unlikely to be the most advanced or the first that's got to our stage of development. If life does exist elsewhere, it's going to be kind of a little flukish or freaky if we're the first.
Chris, science is now saying, of course, that the moon was formed with a collision between Earth and another planetary object. What happened to that object after the collision?
Well, that object, became the moon. So we were hit, supposedly, and it's a theory that actually just
So maybe the moon wasn't carved from us. Maybe the moon is that object that hit us.
Yes, it's probably part of that object. There was this sort of crazy period of planet formation in the solar system when you had sort of 1,000 objects that were the size of asteroids, big asteroids, and they all just crashed together, and some of them obliterated and some of them stuck by gravity, and you built up the terrestrial and the giant planets in a pretty short period of time. So it was chaos, and some of those collisions were violent, and we pretty much got the timing on this that about 50 or 60 million years after the Earth formed, so a very short period of time after the formation, the Earth took a great hit from probably something the size of Mars, and what got splashed off it and then solidified into a little body was the moon, we think.
If we were witnesses to that event, and let's say we're on planet Earth, kind of describe to us what we would see as this object came close to hitting us and then hit us.
Yeah, I mean, the Earth at that time, it would be interesting to be on the Earth because we couldn't live there. I mean, probably the Earth had no life at that time. It was before life formed. But the Earth at that time had barely solidified from being just molten rock. So just imagine the whole Earth as just a big molten rock where the surface is tacky or half melted and not even solidified. There's no oceans because if the water is there at all, it's in the form of steam. It just couldn't have condensed. Everything's too hot. And in that situation, this huge other hot, tacky, barely solidified object slams into the Earth and sprays off molten rock and dust and debris into an orbit, and the stuff gradually gloms together into a new body. And the moon, of course, has changed its distance from the Earth over time. It's moving away from us about a quarter of an inch a year, some very small amount, but it adds up over time. So this is the story. And the story, it's a fantastical story because no one was there to witness it. As you know, you were asking the question, what would it have been like? And the problem is no one was there to witness it. So a fair question is, well, how do we know that happened? It's the geological evidence is really pretty compelling, and it starts with Apollo moon rocks, of course, because we brought back moon rocks and examined them atom by atom, molecule by molecule, and they support this story. And then we also have to explain the strange properties of the moon, because as a satellite of a planet, it has almost no magnetic field, so no metallic core, and it does seem to be slightly younger than the Earth. So there's a set of geochemical pieces of evidence that support this story, even though no one was there to see it.
Chris, would the sound of the collision of the two objects have been just enormous?
I think, the shock waves, I mean, it's space, so there's no sound waves necessarily, but the shock waves and the, the explosive energy of the impact, just phenomenal. I mean, sort of almost unimaginable. I mean, we talk about meteor impacts on the Earth, and we, in our lifetimes, we might see something that's 10, 20 meters, like the Russian event last year or so, that hits the Earth.
Yeah.
And it's pretty impressive. Now you're talking about something the size of Mars hitting the young Earth. I mean, it's unimaginable.
Would it have knocked us out of orbit or into an orbit?
It could have. It's a good question. It could have done either. It could have made our orbit unstable. It could have rearranged the orbit. And in fact, there's evidence, not just for the Earth, but there's evidence in the first half billion years of the solar system history, the first 10% of its history, that the orbits of the planets did actually rearrange a bit. I bet there was a rearrangement of wherever the Earth was before that impact into wherever it is now. Now, that's very hard to deconstruct that history because, again, we just don't know the orbits well enough to play that game. But, yes, it should have moved the Earth around.
It's like two cue balls hitting on a billiard table.
Definitely,
almost,
definitely.
Gosh, fascinating times. Now, would the Earth have had water at that time, oceans?
It didn't have water. There was some of the water there. I mean, and it was just gassing off from this molten rock. So it was probably a shroud, if you like, of steam mixed in with the atmosphere. And then some of the water for the Earth, we think, was delivered a bit later on by meteoric and asteroid and cometary material hitting in this first 100 million years.
That's a lot of comet water.
It is. And we have this amazing evidence from a tiny little crystal of zircon. The oldest rock we know of on the Earth is the 4.402, and it's very accurate, billion-year-old zircon crystal found in Australia. You know, just a little crystal, but the geochemistry of it is fascinating because they've looked at it and they've shown that that crystal formed in a liquid medium. It formed in solution. And so there's this evidence from this one crystal, it's actually supported by other zircons and other evidence, that within about 100 million years of the Earth forming, there was water here. So the water came and the ocean formed not long after the moon formed. All this, it was a very exciting time. A lot of stuff was happening.
That is exciting. We're going to come back and take some phone calls with you, Chris, as we continue talking about space and your work, of course, Dreams of Other Worlds. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment.